gather branches of hazel, oak and ash and thorn, tie them with a green willow, blessed by a crown of horn. The corn headless before us falls down to the side. The green man of the spring, thank the goddess of harvest, thanks to the fallen king. The three men from the west, their fortunes for to try, and they did all agree, John Barleycorn must die. Oh wicker man, oh wicker man, like a mighty god you stand, you are guardian of our land. Take our prayers, O wicker man, O wicker man, O wicker man, like a mighty god you stand, you are guardian of our land. Take our prayers, O wicker man.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Para-X Radio Network. Now, if you were listening closely to the open song by singer-songwriter Dave the Bard, then you already know that tonight we're going to be talking about that iconic figure, the Wicker Man. Now, the song, which was released in January, was inspired by the many Wicker Man celebrations and ceremonies that are becoming more and more popular at pagan festivals, but particularly the one at the mighty Mercian gathering in the UK. And as I listened to the song, I wanted to know more about the origins and the purpose of the Wicker Man, and why this effigy still plays a very big part in our modern world as well. So let's jump right in, not to the Wicker Man, but to Dave the Bard.
Welcome. Hello, Marla. How are you doing? Good to be back. Thanks for inviting me back.
Oh, anytime. It's always my pleasure. I heard this song, and it resonated very strongly with me. And in fact, so much so that I had to go out and find the movie, the original Wicker movie, to see what that had to do with the actual Wicker Man.
Yes.
And it was a little interesting and a little creepy. Everybody said, you know, you've got to watch the first movie, not the one with Nicolas Cage. So yeah. And found the first one, and it was, like I said, very interesting, but it also made me wonder, you know, how true to the truth it really was. So, you know, I know you've been waiting to write this song for a very long time, so let's talk a little about the genesis of the song and the Wicker Man himself.
Sure. Well, I mean, most of the pagans I know have seen the film The Wicker Man. Not, like you say, the Nicolas Cage one. That was a remake. And they completely missed the point, I think, of the first film, because part of the reason it is loved is because I think it's a musical. you know, it's got some fantastic music and songs in there, you know, the Maypole song, Gently Johnny, Willow's song, you know, I mean, I've recorded a couple of those on my past albums because they are just so fantastic. You know, the atmosphere that they create just adds to the film. However, it's not the kind of film you would give to your friends and say, if you want to know about paganism, watch this, you know. It's not the best publicity movie for the pagan community. No. But there's something within it that, you know, maybe it's the idea of an island community living together under pagan, you know, philosophy and that kind of thing, and the kind of sacrifice at the end is a bit of a downer on the whole thing, because up until that point it was kind of cool, you know, and you know, the maypole, things like that. But so I saw that years and years and years ago when I was on holiday with my mum and dad in a caravan. I was very, very small, and they had it on an old black and white portable TV in the caravan, and I had one eye open watching it. So I'll never forget Britt Eklund as long as I shall live. She had a big influence on me as a young man, you know. but then, of course, there is a deeper meaning, because, you know, if you look at the writings of Caesar, he says that the ancient Celts used to fill giant wicker figures with living animals and human beings and then set them on fire and offer them as gifts to the gods. Yeah. So that's one written down version of what the Wicker Man is all about in prehistory. But to be honest, I mean, if you believe what Caesar says about the Gauls and Britons, it's kind of like saying, imagine that Hitler had won the Second World War, and in 2,000 years' time, you believe what he writes about the Jewish people, because he was an invading force. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't there to civilize people with the goodness of Rome. He was there to conquer Britain and Gaul. And what better way to raise money for his war efforts than to paint the people he is, you know, fighting against as barbarians. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did a little research on that there was a great deal of anti-Celtic Druid propaganda being spewed by Caesar, yes, and the Romans way back then.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
He wrote that though the Druids were generally used to finding people that were guilty of crimes and deserving death as they pleased the gods more, they also used slaves and innocent men when no delinquents could be found. I mean, that's pretty slanderous.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And maybe they did. Do you know what I mean? Maybe they did. But, mm-hmm, but you know, for someone, I'll just trump that by saying the Colosseum, right? I mean, come on. I mean, you know, you know, how can you say that people are barbarians when you openly feed people alive to lions as part of sport? I mean, you know, get a grip, you know? Uh-huh.
Yes.
So actually, the whole of the ancient world was pretty rough. Without a doubt. I mean, you know, I dare say, just as the Romans had slaves, I should think the Celts did have slaves. However, the one thing that turned him against the Druids back in the day was Britain was made up of tribes. The idea of a one unified Celtic people is not actually how it was. They were a tribal people, very much like the tribes of the Native Americans. They were... you know, they lived on certain areas of land and they were constantly warring with each other and nicking each other's cattle and all that kind of stuff. But the one unifying force of that day was the Druids. They were the one unifying force between all of the tribes of Britain and Gaul, and that they could walk amongst a battlefield and they, you know, the Druids would not be touched in battle. You know, it was illegal to kill a Druid. And mm-hmm. And of course, the bards were the people who were going between tribes. You know, they were the newspapers of the day. I mean, imagine. I know we've gone way off the Wicker Man topic here. I know
that's
that,
all
but
right.
We'll get back to that. You know, you know, if you imagine a world with no iPods, I know it's terrifying, or an iPhone, or imagine a world with no recorded music, or no newspapers, or no way of knowing what's happening, not just on the, you know, on the other side of the world, but, you know, 20 miles away. And what you've got are these traveling minstrels, traveling bards that will come to your tribe and tell stories of what they've seen in, you know, in far off lands, i.e., you know, lands that maybe be 200 miles away or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was the unifying force. And that's why they put so much effort into conquering them. And you've got the Black Year that is still remembered, you know, by many people on Albion, on the island of Britain. The Black mm-hmm. Year is the year that Boudicca failed and the island of Anglesey, Inis Mon, was sacked by the Romans. Those two things happened in the same year. And mm-hmm. that was what finally... You know, all after that, you know, the resistance was just fell apart because the unifying force of the Druids fell apart, and of course they saw their great hope of Boudicca, you know, failing finally against Paulinus. But anyway, that's a different story. The Wicker Man.
It's all part of it. Yes. No. Because Caesar. Yes. Yeah. We had to give it back.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, there's this idea of a Wicker Man being offered as sacrifice, and but not being filled with living things, but being filled with personal offerings, and that's how it's been brought into kind of modern pagan practice. Mm-hmm. I saw my first Wicker Man in 1998 at a camp run by the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids. Mm-hmm. He was built over the course of 10 days by everybody in the camp, and he was built and constructed within the woods. Mm. And it was Lunasa. Mm-hmm. And the day of the ritual came, and it took almost all of the camp to carry him out of the woods. And it was only when you got him out of the woods, you realized how big he was. He was probably 20 foot tall. Mm-hmm. And we looked at him and thought, how are we going to raise him? How are we going to stand this up? Now we've built this figure. How are we actually going to stand him up? And one of the people who ran O-Bog camps at that time was a chap called Ivan Macbeth. And he's the man responsible for building the stone circle within the Glastonbury Festival grounds, the Swan Circle, that is still there to this day. And his job is, he's got on his passport, megalithic engineer. and the way that they raised the stones in the Glastonbury Festival grounds was with sound. And what they did is they basically, most of us stood around the circle, R-wending on a particular note and vibration, while the other people raised the Wicker Man up. And as we were chanting that sound, so it almost was like the figure floated and just stood up with no effort whatsoever, because the sound and that vibration was enough to, I don't know how it worked. I can't logically say it. It was magic. You know, it was one of those times when you just think, Richard Dawkins worked that one out. I can't work that one out. So he stood up and he was held with massive pegs that were put into the ground and telegraph wire that was held to make him stand up. And he stood just sentinel above the camp all day as the sun set. And then we had a piper who came out and started to pipe us up to the figure. And then the drums started, and then the dancing started, and then the torches were lit, and it was absolutely primal, you know. Mm. And I'd never seen anything like it. I've seen it many times since, but that was the first time I've ever witnessed that kind of ritual. And it was all about thanksgiving, really. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like a bribe of the gods saying, give us a good harvest, because the harvest was already in.
Right.
Was more of a thanksgiving than a kind of like, you know, than the other way around. And most of the Wicker Man ceremonies I've been to since have been at that time of year, either lunar or the spring equinox. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I think that we're reclaiming the Wicker Man now from those kind of rather, you know, insulting words from Caesar. Mm-hmm. we are bringing the Wicker Man into our modern age and making rituals that are suitable for us now, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well I was reading that there are a lot of arguments against what Caesar said, against the possibility of a Wicker Man being technologically sound enough to house sacrificial lambs, so to speak. I mean, you know, and you mentioned in one of your blogs that the first time you were at the festival, as you just said, I mean, it was, you know, how do you raise this thing? It's so huge.
Yes.
And so raising it in of itself is one thing, but just imagine trying to fill it with uncooperative humans and animals. I mean, it's virtually impossible, I think.
I think it would be completely impossible to do that. I mean, I've seen artists' impressions of what they think it looked like. And, you know, if I was in an arm of a big wicker figure, I would just throw myself about until the arm fell off. Do you know what I mean? It wouldn't stand up for it, you know. It just wouldn't. No.
Wicker is not exactly, you know, hard wood that, you know, it would not, if you jumped up and down, would not come off. I mean,
no,
it's all this propaganda, you know, it really kind of, as I was reading it, it really kind of made me chuckle. And as I was listening to your song, I mean, some of the lyrics are so visually compelling. As you're listening, I mean, like, what starts with the smallest ember is fed like blood through veins, kissed by an arrow and aroused into towering flames. And anybody that has seen a picture of the Wicker Man or watched it burn in the movies, you know, you can see that this is a very compelling thing.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad it's coming back into remembrance and respect and everything, because I mean that's what it was. But the question I think that I kept running into, or the comment as I was reading up a little bit more, was whether or not there was human sacrifice at that time. There was some archaeological evidence from the British Isles that seems to indicate that human sacrifice may have been practiced over that kind of long predated any contact with Rome. And human remains have been found at the foundations of structures from the Neolithic time to the Roman era. And what they found were injuries and positions that argue for there being foundation sacrifices. Mm-hmm. But and then there was a medieval commentary from the 10th century that states that men were burned in a wooden mannequin in sacrifice to Tyrannus. So, mm-hmm. It kind of goes back and forth, but, you know, I've always thought of the ancient Druids as philosophers, teachers, magicians. I mean, in other words, a very peaceful lot. Maybe some question that way back when they might have practiced human sacrifice.
I think it's very dangerous to paint ancient civilizations with modern morals.
Yes.
I think that basically, particularly if you're a quite happily fed Western world human being,
uh-huh.
who can just pop down to Walmart and buy a very nice ribeye steak and bring it home. Do you know what I mean? And yes. We don't know as a people what it's like to survive purely for the food we grow ourselves.
Yes.
And what you've got in ancient times is a country full of basically subsistence farmers who are raising cattle and crops for their own use. You know, mm-hmm. very little of it would have been traded. You know, we weren't ripping off Africa to grow all of our food for us at that stage. We were growing it ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we lived and we died by those crops.
Yes.
It was life or death. There was no way out. If those crops failed, the tribe would die.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you can just drop your, or not your, but if we can mm-hmm. just drop our Western moralistic way of viewing the world and just say, if that was me and I did not know that the sun would rise and be warm again because I hadn't the knowledge of that science behind me at that stage, would I not say we need to do something?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and I'm not saying it's right and I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it probably at that point in time made sense to those people.
Sure.
And when you look at any ancient culture, we're talking about the Iron Age and the Bronze Age. We're talking, you know, between 3000 BC and maybe 100 BC. Mm-hmm. You look all over the world and pretty much every ancient culture was doing some form of sacrifice. Even if you look at the mm-hmm. Old Testament, if you just flick it open, a random page, you're going to come across something that says, and he offered burnt meat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it highly likely that just as, you know, the people of the Middle East, the people of South America were deeply superstitious about the movings of the planets and the stars, and also very dependent on their own food, I would think that they may well have done it here as well, you know. Mm-hmm. But I can't cast a damning eye and say that is evil, because I am very, very blessed to have Tesco's. Do you know what I mean? You know, I don't shop at Tesco's, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A supermarket where I can go and just pick stuff off the shelf. If those people back then could get into a time machine and went to a supermarket like a Walmart, I think they'd have a coronary attack. They just would not believe the amount of food that it could be possible to hold in one place at one time, you know?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah. I can't view them as evil. I just view them as trying their best to survive, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And they had to kind of go by their will and by their instincts, I think.
Yeah.
And it was not, as you said, it was not current day time. People had way different sensibilities and opinions, and basically, I mean, yes, they say in this day and age that we're here to survive. Well, compared to what the ancients had, we don't know the first thing about survival. I mean,
absolutely,
it's just that simple.
Yeah,
but yeah, you know, there is talking about druids for a minute. You know, they were also the priests who carried out religious rituals from the Iron Age Britain. But I read where most modern druids have no direct connection to the druids of the Iron Age. Is that a fair statement? And if so, how do you define the modern age druid?
I think if anyone was to ever say to you that they had a direct lineage back to the Iron Age from their druidry, I would treat them very. I would ask them to prove it, because. Mm-hmm. I think that teaching, there is no unbroken line. However, they also apparently never wrote anything down.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have is archaeology,
mm-hmm.
and what archaeology can teach us about how people lived back in the day. We have the poetry of Taliesin, of Myrddin, of Amagin. We have the stories of the Mabinogion, and we have the Táin in Ireland, and we have the teachings and the stories of Finn McCool. We have all of those myths, and we also have the last 300 years of history of a modern druidic movement. And it's like, you know, I think some people can tear their hair out, and, you know, wishing for something concrete so that they can just look at a menu and choose their druidry, yeah?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's what it's like with a lot of the written, you know, the religions of the book. They've got a book that they can be in, they're in the restaurant, you know, they're ordering their stuff because they've got their menu.
Uh-huh.
But see, the druid in this modern age, we're not in the restaurant, we're in the kitchen. Right? We have got all of the ingredients there, all of it, to basically make it ourselves, make it relevant to our day. And I find that far more exciting than having a book written down that tells me exactly what I'm doing, you know?
Well, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, because somebody else wrote it and their sensibility may not be yours.
Exactly. So we've got all of these. Sorry.
No, I just said it's freedom of choice, kind of, you know.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, you've got quite strict reconstructionist druids who look at history, look at the mythologies that were written down, the poetry that was written down, archaeology, and they will build their druidry based on those quite strict parameters, trying to recreate a modern druidry based on what they know of the ancient druids. I'm a little bit more than that. I would rather go into the woods and and be with a ancient yew tree for the night of Samhain, for instance.
Yes.
And just sit there, Samhain Eve, by a yew in a dark woods, and the feelings I would get from that, and the images I would get, and the emotional connection taught to that time of year I would get, kind of teaches me more than any book would, I think.
Mm-hmm. Because, there are so many misconceptions about druids, you know, that they were monotheists, they came from Atlantis, that they were celibate. Now that's a good one. And but the popular ideas about the Druids are based on the misunderstandings and the misconception of scholars of 200 years ago. And I think today, well, there is still some mystery surrounding Druids. So why do you think that is?
That's the great thing about it, though, isn't it? That's
yes.
Like, would you really want someone to catch the Loch Ness Monster?
No, not at all.
No, you want to preserve the mystery. You know, you want that. You want to be able to use your imagination. You want to be able to dream and to create your image of what the Loch Ness Monster could be. And if somebody caught it, it would just be, you know, oh, it's a big whale or whatever, and the whole thing would tumble, you know. And I think the fact that there is mystery about the ancient Druids means that we have something tangible, spiritual, that we can tap into. It's like I often think of, you know, there's a lot of people who get their information about the old ancient gods from books. Yeah, mm-hmm. they will read, you know, a Celtic scholar's review of the Morrigan, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the Morrigan really exists, does she really need to speak through the words of that academic?
Mm-mm.
Or can you not actually talk to her directly?
Exactly.
And ask her what she is. If she's real, she'll talk back. And I think she's real, you know. So, and, you know, I have read lots of books, obviously, but I don't tend to have them as my be all and end all. I want a personal relationship with these old gods. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, we're all pablum fed lots of things in our lifetimes. And a lot of people, I guess I'm going to use a bad comment, but a lot of people are sheep and will follow what they read and take that as gospel. Mm. But I think it's much wiser to use your mind to think for yourself, to come to your own conclusions and follow what you believe.
Yeah, I think it's important to do both, to be quite honest with you. I think, you know, I've met people who do carry that academic stuff around like a big, mm-hmm. it's like a big, you know, burden on their back. Uh-huh. And unless somebody's written down that that's what that god does, then they can't do it. And you just think, uh-huh. well, you know, maybe a personal relationship to balance that is also a good idea. You know, mm-hmm. so yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to diss academia because it's very important.
No.
You know.
Well, yeah.
So yeah.
It's good for basic facts, but they're not. You know, the academia is not what rules each and every one of us inside.
Yeah.
And so we have to take the knowledge that's offered and then kind of process it in such a way that it resonates to us.
That's right, and that, funnily enough, just right back to the Wicker Man ceremonies again, because that's exactly what we've done. We've taken the words of Caesar, we've taken a rather dodgy 70s movie, and we've said, well, okay, if that's what it's told us, what do we feel what do we feel it's for now? And and I think that a lot of spells are, you know, done for, you know, monetary gain or for love or that kind of thing, to manipulate the universe to give you something you want.
Mm-hmm.
But the Wicker Man isn't for that. The Wicker Man is to say, thank you for my family. Thank you for the breath of my lungs. Thank you for the life of this planet. Thank you for my children. Thank you for the life I've been given, you know, no matter what, with its ups and downs and everything that goes with it. And mm-hmm. and that's been the energy behind the Wicker Man. And yes. Just to add one more little image, you know, you mentioned the what starts with the smallest ember is fed by, like, blood through veins, kissed mm-hmm. by a flaming arrow, aroused into towering flames. That is absolutely the story of the Wicker Man at the Mercian gathering.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is in the center of a big circle of people, and they light him by arrow. They fire a flame. Mm-hmm. They fire flaming arrows at him, and it's those flaming arrows that catch him alight. And all through the weekend, people have been visiting him. They've been tying on little corn dollies. They've been tying on their hair, little offerings of thanks, so that when he goes up, he takes all of those wishes with him, you know, into the gods, you know. So, yeah.
I think, you know, it is. I mean, describing it, and I hope everybody will replay this song and actually go out and buy it, but just to give you that sense of the way things are, it's not modern day, it's not push a button, it's not, you know, whatever. It takes you back to the ancient ones, and as most people know, I'm very much attached to the ancient ways, as opposed to everything technologically sound and making a whole lot of sense, you know, in some people's minds. So the ceremony of the Wicker Man is absolutely fascinating. And I was actually looking to see if there are any festivals of the sort here in the States. And angrily came up with the Burning Man Festival. Now,
yes,
I don't know if you know much about that, but it takes place here in the Nevada desert. And despite what most people believe, it is not at all a pagan festival, and in fact it may very well be anti-pagan. The creator of the festival states that he has no knowledge of the Wicker Man before he created this art festival, as he calls it, and he goes on to say that participants in the Burning Man tend to be very highly educated. They often work in the professions, and they're likely to be more familiar with the writings of postmodern intellectuals than that of the works of, say, Edgar Cayce. And he's completely adamant in insisting that the Burning Man was never intended to actually represent anything, and that it was simply an act of radical self-expression, an arts festival, if you will. And I've known people that have gone to Burning Man, not pagans at all, and, you know, it seemed kind of sacrilegious in some ways to those of us who knew of the Wicker Man and stuff, because it seemed like a copycat kind of thing, even though this guy denies it vehemently, but only probably because he got approached by it and said, hey, you know, you got that from the Wicker Man or something.
Yeah.
But I can't find, haven't found any Wicker Man festivals here in the States, and that surprised me.
Well, that's exciting, because that means that there can be a first one.
Well, yes. Now, if I only knew how to build a Wicker Man and could gather 900 people to raise it, you know, we might be in good shape.
Yeah,
I just, I thought it was odd because, I mean, it, even though I think a lot of pagans here in the States do not come out of the closet, the broom closet, and talk about their belief systems as much as they may do in Europe, there certainly are tens of thousands, if not millions of us out here that should be doing something like that for the right reasons, you know?
Yeah,
it blows me away.
Well, you know, it's I don't know why. I mean, it took a long time for us to start doing it here in Britain, and the gap between that 1998 and the first Mercian gathering. I mean, it was probably 6 years until I saw my next Wicker Man ritual. Yeah. And that was at a camp that myself and Kerry organized, the Andera de Gorseth camps. And we just thought we'll bring that energy to our camps. And without me knowing it, that was the first year that the Mercian gathering started as well. And they've had a Wicker Man every year. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a lot of work to put these things together. You know, you can't just turn up at a camp for a weekend and do it. You need a lot of material and a lot of, you know, a lot of work and a lot of skill. You need skilled people with you as well. So it would take organizing. I mean, I've been to the Pagan Spirit Gathering, Selena Fox's group, you know, the Circle Sanctuary, and they do a beautiful silent labyrinth lit by candles on one of their nights. And if, you know, if any of the camps I've been to are capable of of doing a Wicker Man. You know, it's going to be the PSG because there's 1,000 people there, and you know, it's the perfect situation to do it. The thing is, it would take a week to build it, and people don't necessarily want to go to a camp and spend all week building it. You know, so I'm sure it will happen. I'm sure it will happen. If it hasn't happened already, you'll probably get somebody write in and say, actually, you know, it happened at our camp, you know, wherever they are. You know, I'm sure these things have taken place.
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have been to a Wicker Man ritual in the States, you know, write in and say so. Yeah, because people want to know it exists.
That's right. We do.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I want talk about a couple of things in regards to the Wicker Man song. You sing about John Barleycorn. And, you know, a lot of people, and it took me until not very recently, but a very short time after I started looking into things like this, I did not even know what John Barleycorn represented years and years ago. And I think a lot of people maybe don't. They think he's, you know, just some guy that, you know, grows corn or something. I don't know. Can you explain to those who may not be familiar with John Barleycorn who or what he is?
Okay. The name John Barleycorn comes from a song called John Barleycorn. It has the words, "There were three men came out of the West, their fortunes for to try. And these three men made a solemn vow, John Barleycorn must die. They ploughed, they sowed, they harrowed him in, threw clods upon his head. And these three men made a solemn vow, John Barleycorn was dead." And then, of course, he throws up his head on Midsummer's Day and there becomes a man. And the whole song is a story of the planting, growing of the corn in the fields. And when I say corn, what I mean is barley and wheat, you know, the grass, not your, is it maize? Yeah, so it's not kind of corn on the cob. When they're saying John Barley, when they're saying John Barleycorn, what they mean by that is the barley, is the grasses, you know, the cereal crop that makes bread, goes into making bread. And brandy and beer, obviously, as well. and so John Barleycorn is the spirit of the field. He is the embodiment of the green man that grows at spring and brings leaf, like leaf from bud. Yeah, but he's gone through the year and he's now growing in the fields, and As the year goes on, he goes from green to gold, and he becomes an old man with a crooked cane and a beard. And that's all. If you look at some forms of corn, they've got long sort of straggly bits that look like a beard.
Yes.
And so he is the personification of that in the field. And of course, it comes a time of lunacy, and he's cut down by the scythe. They cut him at the knee, and they rolled him and tie him around the waist, serving him most barbarously. And and then, of course, he's ground between two stones, and that then goes off to make the bread and the beer, and it's that spirit of sacrifice. That's the spirit of sacrifice that is honoured as well within the Wicker Man. And there's a tradition here still in some farms of keeping the last few stalks of corn standing, and they basically have a game of throwing a sickle at these three last few strands of corn, and whoever cuts it lifts them up and says, "I have the neck." Yeah. And that's the final falling of John Barleycorn of the field. And so that is his inclusion within the Wicker Man is part of the thankfulness of the sacrifice that we've been talking about, for a thanksgiving for our food and our drink, and also an honouring of the gift of life that has been taken and is then given. And we should do that with all of our food. We should do that with our meat. We should do that with everything, because to eat, something has to die, even if it's corn in a field, you know. Mm-hmm. And very often that Thanksgiving is sadly missing.
Yes.
You know, even when you're tapping into your nice lamb chop, you know, there should be a moment where you say, where you just thank the animal for that gift of life, you know. And that's yes. that is also the energy of the Wicker Man ceremony.
Yeah, well, we take that for granted, you know. I mean, it's nobody's fault, but we do. But, you know, it was funny because the first time I heard the song John Barleycorn, I was a teenager and was probably listening with one ear like most teenagers do. Mm-hmm. And as I was listening to the lyrics, I kept thinking, oh, my God, this is terrible. They're murdering this man. They're doing, you know.
I'm not thinking about it.
I had no clue. And I thought, oh, my God, these are pagans. How could they do such a thing? You know, so that's, I think, you know, for somebody that isn't familiar with it and hears a reference to him or hears the song John Barleycorn, you know, they would just be aghast. You know, it's horrible. Yeah. So that's why I wanted to talk a little bit about it, the symbolism of it and what it really was. Because I was scandalized for about 10 minutes until I did some further research. And I thought, okay. Well,
it's the good old vegetation myth from Fraser's Golden Bough book, isn't it, really? That's what mm-hmm. it is. It's the green man, it's the god of the fields, and the way he's born and the way he dies, and then waits within the other world for the coming, you know, for the goddess to return. Mm-hmm. At Samhain, you know, when between Samhain and the winter solstice, a lot of people say that the land is without the god or goddess at that time. And that's the point where everything starts to really die away, you know, because it's bereft of the gods, you know. They've gone back to Annwn. They've gone back to the Celtic underworld. And of course, at the winter solstice, that tiny little spark of light is reborn as the Mabon, the mm-hmm. divine child. The mm-hmm. you know, Christians call him Christ. Druids often call him the Mabon, and we're off again. You know, you know, and the wheel spins and turns.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
Took the words right out of my mouth. They spun right out from me to you. You know, it's so fascinating to even talk about this stuff, to learn and grow and embrace the things that we don't know as well as we probably should. You know, you talk about the Mercian Gathering, which is not a festival, but it's a pagan camp. And yeah. This year it'll be celebrating its 10th anniversary. You will be there. Yeah. When will it be taking place?
It's on the last the first weekend in September. Okay. That's the time. And actually, we were talking before the show about Adrienne from Spiral Dance. Well, Spiral Dance are also going to be playing at the Mercian Gathering. They're coming over from Australia to play there this year. Which will just be fantastic because I'll share the stage with them in the UK, and I usually do that in Australia. So, first weekend. So first weekend in September, and the weekend is opened with a big ceremony, and a beautiful ceremony through a labyrinth that is made of straw, basically. And then on the Saturday night, that labyrinth of straw is set on fire. So they have a fire labyrinth that everyone walks through. And then we head off in big procession. There's about 1,000 people at the Mercian Gathering. It's the biggest camp. It's the biggest pagan camp in the UK. And, you know, when you get 1,000 people around a Wicker Man drumming and chanting and singing, you can imagine being from any time. You know, you look at the stars and you think those are the same stars that my ancestors looked up to 2,000 years ago, and here I am with my people in my time, and we're doing a similar thing for similar reasons, you know.
Yes, and people don't understand, that maybe have not done that. It it will take you out of the 20th century. It will take you right back to where our ancestors were.
Yeah.
It's a very wonderful kind of grounding feeling to take part in those kinds of ceremonies and festivals and camps and everything, because we all need a break from modern times. I mean, there's no question about it. And a lot of people, though, mistakenly believe that this is the only time there was, and this is the only time there is or will be. To be able to go back and have that feeling, I mean, it just bubbles up inside you and clears your head. I mean, it's a wonderful kind of catharsis, I would think, for those who haven't tried it.
Yeah. I think the thing is, you know, I love a lot of the technology of the modern age. I love my Mac, for instance. You know, I love my you know, iPhone and all those things. But every now and again, you know, one of the things that is that our ways of life have basically, they've kind of created a little separation between humans and the natural world. You know, oh, let's go and look at nature without realizing we are still part of nature. You know, we are nature. You know, New York is nature. It's just what we've done as part of nature. You know, it's no different, but we seem to have this idea that we're separate. So, you know, going and basically stripping down your needs for the weekend, just living, you know, under canvas, and then, you know, simple eating, that kind of thing, and then a fireside. Fire is the thing that does it as well, because you know, it's called bushcraft TV sometimes, you know, it's wilderness. So, you know, and if you have a fire with a load of people sitting around that fire under the stars, and then somebody gets up and they say, you know, and they say, let me tell you the story. Stories of Prince of David, the ruler of the seven cantrebs of that kingdom, and starts reciting, you know, some of the Mabinogion. You really could be at any time, and those are the moments I cherish as being a pagan. You know, those are the moments that I live for. You know.
Yes, and you know, listening to your music, listening to the lyrics, we'll do the same thing. Which is why it's so lovely. I mean, and it goes across the board. It's not just one topic. This is the thing, you know. I mean, you can go from listening to John Barleycorn, you can go from listening to The Spirit of Albion, then you can turn into turn on the Bonnie Black Hair, and it's completely different, you know. or the Two Magicians, or Twa Corbies, you know, whatever. It will take you anywhere you want to go. I mean, it's like, you know, dial up, what are you in the mood for today? But listening to the lyrics and embracing them.
Thank you.
And you sing them with such feeling that it is a quick fix for those of us who can't, you know, go out into the woods right now, you know.
Yeah.
I can turn them on. It's
get the headphones on, drift off.
Exactly. It's amazing. And I think that is one of the reasons that pagan music, well, music from day one has been an important part of life. But to be able now to listen to the songs that were sung and the stories that were told, it is all about storytelling. And there's very storytellers out there, very few good storytellers out there. That and then there are people who can sing these songs and have no knowledge of what they're all about, but you know what you sing, you know what you write. It brings a whole different aspect into just listening to music.
Well, it's all I do. It's what I love, you know. It always has been, you know. And actually, it's one of the important things about it is I know that some people look at pagan music and they go, "Oh, it's all folk music" or something like that, you know. And I know maybe I get that criticism because my songs are also basically acoustic folk. But there's a reason for that. I want my songs to be able to be played totally acoustically around a campfire by anyone who can play an instrument. You know, I don't want them to have to need to plug in a Marshall stack and a PA system to be able to get the message or the feeling of their song, of their songs. You know, I want them to be so that that troubadour, that bard, can step into that firelit circle with their guitar or their mandolin or their bouzouki or their harp, sit down completely acoustically and capture that magical moment, just as bards have done for thousands of years, you know. Mm-hmm. And to do that, it's got to be folk music, you know. It can't be electric music. I mean, I love electric music. One of my favorite albums recently has been S.J. Tucker's Ember Days soundtrack. It was just astounding, you know. But I think she would say herself, it's her acoustic songs that will come to that campfire, you know, not the Nine Inch Nails stuff, you know. So so that's why, I guess, it's good to explain that. You know, there's a reason behind what I do, and I want it to be as portable as possible, you know. And that, you know, yeah.
Great, yes, explanation.
Thank you.
And when you said Nine Inch Nails, all I could think of was, those are what you bring when you build a wicker man, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's what you hold out with.
A little bit of hemp and a little bit of nail and a little bit of, you know, whatever you can lash off and see, a little vine or something. So the wicker man at the festivals, are they built with wood, or are they actually built with straw, wicker, that kind of thing?
On the whole, they're built with hazel and willow, probably are the two major woods that are used. Willow is very bendable, and so it's, you know, you can tie, you can make willow withies out of basically destroying a willow branch and then taking the strands of the wood, and it will act like a string, and the body shape of the wicker man is often coppiced hazel to create that kind of cage shape and things like that. So I would say it's mainly willow and hazel to create with, but then you can also stuff it with straw. But the problem with straw is all that will happen is it will go woof, and all the straw will go, and it will just be left with this cage, you know. So what it needs is from the bottom, it needs very, very tiny little, you know, pencil sized bits of dry wood getting bigger and bigger as it goes up, so that it starts with the kind of embers and then builds up as it goes through the figure, and that will then draw and also leave loads of space of air as well, because that encourages the fire to burn. So, yeah, and one of the things we did at one of our Anderida camps is we built the wicker man, but we actually did leave the chest cavity open, and we put a little gate on it. And before all of your listeners run away screaming, thinking, what did you do next? what we had is we had a camp that was themed on the wicker man of the film. So we opened the Friday night with a concert of all of us singing all of the songs from the Wicker Man.
Nice.
And then the adults were making corn dollies, and they were imbibing them with their Thanksgiving and things like that, and all the things that they were happy with their lives, they were putting into these corn dollies. And what we did is we then went to a separate part of the field, and we had masked processions, torchlit, coming across with pipe and drum, leading us down through the fields to the waiting wicker man. And what happened then is within the circle was formed by the people. Everyone had their corn dollies. All of the corn dollies were tied onto this little figure. And then that figure with all of the blessings and all of Thanksgiving was then put into the cage itself. And that was what was offered up to the gods. And it was a beautiful, beautiful thing, you know, they loved it, and so did we. And if you look on my website, the video that I put together for the song The Wicker Man, those images were taken at that camp.
Nice. Speaking of that, where can people find the videos and your blogs and of course, your music.
Well, the hub of Dave, of all things Dave on the internet, is my website, at and that is paganmusic.co.uk. That's paganmusic.co.uk. And on there is, you know, links to the, it's, you know, the podcast that I do for the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids, right. You know, my store, my blog, all of those kinds of things, Facebook page, Twitter feed, all those things are on that website.
And also people can join your newsletter.
They can, yes. Yeah, yeah. I do a monthly newsletter that's free, that's sent out just on the front page of the website. If people want to subscribe to that, they can do that. If they want to hear my ramblings once a month.
And they should, because they're very interesting. I love them. I look forward to them. I learn a lot. You know, fortunately, I'm not too old to learn new tricks. So I read and learn.
I don't think any of us are. Yeah.
Well, you know, we have burned up, using the vernacular, an hour.
Really?
Wow. We have.
It doesn't feel like it. Wow.
No, it doesn't. And so I really just want to thank you so much for coming in. And thank you for that song. I loved it. It made me learn a lot, and it was a pleasure talking about it tonight.
You're very welcome. Nice to speak to you again, Marla. Thank you.
All right. And everybody, thank you for joining us. And as usual, blessed be, and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2013. Moonlight Hall by Kevin MacLeod, licensed through Incompetech.com.